Hello, Percolated Media listeners. Welcome to this review of Dr. Sleep. Just a little heads up as we get into this. This recording was done quite a few months ago. It was originally done for Binge Media. You'll hear references to Binge throughout the course of this podcast. Reason why it wasn't posted on there, just couldn't find scheduling. And when they said it was time to, you know, put out our last one, I wanted our last one to be a goodbye to listeners of Binge and not necessarily just another review. But it's perfect because it's the perfect bridge between Binge and our brand new venture. So here it is in all its form. Enjoy and come back next week. We got a hell of a lot more planned. Thanks, guys.
Hi there.
Where did you find those?
I know all the secret places.
You're wondering why I'm wearing such a funny hat. I always wear this hat.
So much, it's a part of my name now. My friends, my very, very best friends, they just call me Rose the Hat.
From the chilling halls of the Overlook Hotel, I bid you welcome to the Binge Movie Aftertaste Shining Retrospective.
Now, by God, you are going to take your medicine.
Listen in as Garrett.
Wendy, I'm home.
Matt.
Are you out of your fucking mind?
And Adam.
I love the little son of a bitch.
Continue their look at the film adaptations of author Stephen King's work.
Whenever you come in here and interrupt me, you're breaking my concentration.
From Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Words of wisdom, Lloyd. Words of wisdom.
To the TV miniseries directed by Mick Garris.
This doesn't have to be painful, Wendy.
All the way to Mike Flanagan's Dr. Sleep.
Don't worry, that's my friend.
The boys look at the hotel halls and wonder if there are indeed ghosts in the Overlook's walls.
You called it Shining.
How did Adam see the original Shining for the very first time?
That is quite a story.
Is the miniseries worth King's efforts to overthrow Kubrick's original vision?
Wrong!
And how the hell did Mike Flanagan make nice of King and Kubrick's estates with his movie, Dr. Sleep?
And for a long time, I thought it was just the two of us that had the shine to us.
Come play with us, listeners, and find out the answers to all these questions and more, all coming up, courtesy of Binge Media.
No, stay a while. See more magic.
Dr. Sleep. Released November 8th, 2019. Budget was $55 million. Box office, when totaled, came up to $72.3 million. And this was directed by Mike Flanagan. All right, boys, let's back up a little bit. 1977, The Shining book comes out. 1980, The Shining movie comes out. Both end up being pretty popular pieces of pop culture. But book and movie didn't really like each other. And they went through a divorce that I haven't seen this ugly since that of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. We're not even going to discuss that 1997 thing that we discussed last week anymore, but cut to 2019. Actually, no, cut to 2013. Dr. Sleep, the book, comes out. And then 6 years later, here's Mike Flanagan's version. Matt, had you read Dr. Sleep before you went and saw it?
No, I did not, because I had someone describe to me what the book was about, and I was unaware that it was a sequel to The Shining. So I had a buddy who's a hardcore bookworm. He goes, oh, I got the new Stephen King book. I'm like, oh, what's it about? Because I know he puts out a book pretty much every year. He goes, it's about the kid from The Shining, and he grows up to fight vampires. I'm like, that sounds fucking stupid. How big is the book? And he shows me a picture, and I'm like, oh, I don't have I'm glad I don't have the time to commit to reading that, because that premise did not excite me at all. And the thing about King is, he doesn't write a lot of sequels. When you look at his career, outside of The Dark Tower, which is sort of its own beast, he really doesn't do retreading previous stories, you know, building on those characters. He does kind of have his own, like, Marvel level of universe with the mythology, but I was not in tune with the book. I still have not read it to this day, but I did get more intrigued when I heard the movie was coming out because of the director attached, some of the actors attached, and King had sort of had a resurgence, at least in the movies, over the past 5-6 years. I was very excited to go see the movie. We'll sort of talk about that maybe a little bit more, but as far as reading the book, I have not touched it. I don't own it, but maybe I'll check it out to see if what the consensus is, because some people say the movie's better, some people say the book's better. Pretty even split, so I'm curious to get my own opinion eventually.
All right, before I go to Adam, I do want to interject here. This book came out to Stephen King's book club. So I got a copy of this thing, and I had seen that he was coming out with this. And I had seen him come out in interviews and say he was writing a sequel to The Shining, and it's going to be his scariest book that he's written in decades. This was his quote. I get this book, and I was actually kind of excited to read it. I'm like, let's see here. Because in the lead up to this, like, he would go to signings and things and go to conventions, and people would ask him, you know, are you ever going to do a sequel to The Shining? He said, well, in my mind, Danny marries Charlie from Firestarter, and they move to Salem's Lot, and they live happily ever after. That was always his answer, okay? So he wasn't going to do it, but the idea intrigued him very much so. As a recovering alcoholic himself, as a recovered alcoholic, I should say, he was interested in diving into AA and how Danny would deal with everything that he went through in that first film. Because if you remember, in the first book, Jack quit cold turkey. He didn't go to AA because at that point, Stephen King didn't even know what AA was. So he wanted to see what a member of his family would do going through AA. He thought that was intriguing. So I'm seeing some of the press leading up to this. And like you, Matt, I saw, wow, Danny fights vampires. This is interesting. Discounting The Dark Tower, because there's about 3 or 4 of those I haven't read. But I have read probably about 90 to 95% of Stephen King's output. This book was the bottom 5 of worst books he has ever written.
Ooh.
I hated this book when I initially read it. And I went to the movie initially, my arms crossed saying, all right, Flanagan, let's see what you can do. And we'll talk about what he does here. But I did not like this book at all. I did reread it for this podcast because I'm going through all his bibliography going in here. So I do have different feelings now than I did then, some different feelings. But at that time, I couldn't stand this book. Adam, were you even at the very least intrigued at this sequel to a movie / book that you didn't even like the first time you watched it?
I was aware of it. I also knew that Stephen King doesn't, and as you said, in the traditional sense, do sequels. I did follow and read The Dark Tower quite a bit when I was younger, both literary and graphic novel-wise. So it intrigued me, and then I looked into what the premise was. Around the time the movie was coming out, I looked into what the premise was and who was in it, and I was surprised that it didn't say that it was written by Paul Sheldon, because I think the writer of this definitely has a crutch that they need to use. I steered away.
You steered away. So this was your first time watching it.
This obviously was my very first time watching. And I was actually, though, after watching The Shining and then watching The Shining, I was ready to go into this one. I mean, preconceived notions from the book, 5 or 6 years ago, and the movie only 2 or 3 years ago. I was actually pretty excited to take a look and delve, and especially the cast had me pretty excited to get into this.
The cast was interesting. I'll definitely give it that. And Mike Flanagan, you know, Matt, you mentioned Flanagan. I'm a pretty big fan of the guy myself as well. I enjoy the mood he sets up. Now, let's not forget, this is a guy who had already done a King adaptation before he took this on. He had done Gerald's Game, which was looked at as a big success because that was looked at as an unfilmable book. We'll get to our thoughts of Gerald's Game in a few years, but he did that, which was deemed unfilmable, and he did that. This guy does so many things that are deemed unfilmable, and he still does really interesting things with it. Last night, to prepare for this podcast, I did watch his Netflix film Hush, which I had never seen before. And it's not a great film, but the mood that guy sets up is fucking phenomenal. And you just, he does so many things. And what he does is he takes things that you think you know and he turns them on its head. You think looking at Hush that it's just a regular slasher film about a girl getting stalked in her house. It's not. I thought going in, if there was anything that could be redeemed about this book, this guy would be the one to do it. The conundrum that this guy was under, he had to film this book from Stephen King, but he came up with the idea of making a movie King to this day still talks shit about canon. And he had to say, look, people remember the Kubrick version of your book, so I'm going to put that in this movie. Now, back in 1980... you know, King didn't have the power to say, well, you know, I would like if you didn't do this, you didn't do that. He didn't have any of that. He had that today. He has that now. So he had to get both King and, by the way, the Kubrick estate to sign off on this before he did it. The balls on this motherfucker have got to be fucking huge, man. Because I don't know how you have that conversation. I don't know how you approach that. I don't know how you get a guy who hated that movie and still to this day talks shit about it to sign off on it, but he did. We'll talk about how successful he was at it, but the fact that he got this fucker made and he actually made it a sequel to a movie that the original author, who now has more power, because like you said, Matt, he had a resurgence. It got this springboarded. This was going to be, and I mentioned last week, this was going to be a prequel. This was going to be how the hotel came to existence with Mrs. Massey and Horace Durant, all of them getting this hotel to this massive spirit that it was. But once it came out, all those plans were scrapped, and they said, fuck it, we're doing the one with King's name on it. And the fact that Flanagan was able to take this and do what he did with it, fucking quite an accomplished feat.
As a creative person, puts you in the ultimate situation of you have to please both masters. You got to please the King purists.
Yes.
And you also have to please the Kubrick worshippers. And you kind of, because they're so diametrically opposite, you run the risk of you're either going to please both or you're going to please neither.
No.
Like, I don't think you could have one without the other. And I think this, I would consider this more unadaptable than Gerald's Game, to be perfectly honest. With what he set out he had set out to make. And it speaks a lot as to how much King likes Flanagan and the studio in particular. Even though the movie did not do gangbusters, it barely made, it lost money because you got a big double. Yeah, they still gave him the green light to do a director's cut, yeah. which I did watch for this viewing. I watched both cuts. And the director's cut is a half hour longer. It is not a like extended cut where we'll put in 3 minutes here, 30 seconds there. And the director's cut ends with like a wall of text from Flanagan saying like, thank you, Warner Brothers, for believing in the project. And thank you to Mr. King for not, you know, locking me in the trunk like Frank Vincent and Goodfellas and stabbing me.
Yeah, King loves this. King came out and he said that he can't stop himself. Because what he said about this was, it redeems everything that was wrong with the Kubrick version.
I'm amazed that Stephen King, at this point in his life, has not driven to Kubrick's grave and done where he whips his dick out and pisses all over it. Like, that's the only thing he has left to do to in his window of throwing pot shots at Stanley Kubrick.
It's unbelievable, man. All right, so we open up with the familiar strings of the Shining soundtrack, that thumping heartbeat. And we see that it is Florida in 1980, and we meet Rose the Hat as she talks to a little girl. Now, this chick is going to be our main antagonist throughout this movie. Matt, you and I have reviewed Rebecca Ferguson in the Mission Impossible series. How do we feel she does here?
Insert obligatory comment about how much I love the snowman here.
That's right. She is in that.
I think she is fucking terrific in this movie. It's very rare in King's tome, basically. He doesn't have a lot of female antagonists. I think of Andy Wilkes. I think of, you could argue, the bully Chris in Carrie. I think this is a sort of a masterstroke where this character could have been just insane witch lady. If you notice, Ferguson speaks with a very light Irish accent from time to time, which adds a lot. I got hardcore Pennywise vibes from this opening scene. And I do think there are components of this movie that play sort of like Stephen King's greatest hits. And I think that's, not having read the book, but knowing the context now, I feel like he's ripping from himself a lot with this material while still trying to make it tied to The Shining. But I think Rose the Hat is one of the best characters he's written in a very long time. And I think Ferguson knocks it out of the park.
One change I'm glad that Flanagan made was in the book, when this chick feeds, there's like this tusk/tooth that like just appears out of her head. And King put that in the book. And thank Christ Flanagan did not interject that, because my God, would that have looked fucking silly.
In King, so many King's movies, it seems like the menace is just the atmosphere, where I feel for the first time in a while we get a character that's actually scary.
I think Rebecca Ferguson does what she does with this material very well. I think this character is, like a lot of things in this movie, in this book, in this original material, just too broad a stroke for me. I think Flanagan has narrowed it down the way he has, and that's a good thing. I really do, because not only did I mention the tusk that appears out of her, but there are other things in that book that, like the hat in the book is actually a magic hat. You have to basically stomp the hat in order to kill this girl in that book. All of that's not here, which is good. Yeah, and I think what she does is good. Like the way she's very Pennywise-ish, as you said, Matt, suckering this girl in, is very good. My feelings on her aren't necessarily what Rebecca Ferguson does. It's with the character, whereas she's the main antagonist. Yet, I don't feel like she's ever in control. I don't feel like this character ever is a threat to Danny or to Abra in the course of this film. So that's not a problem with the acting, though. I think Ferguson does great with this. So she's telling this little girl that her hat is a magic hat and that she is special. And this is when the true knot. And by the way, Adam, every time I heard that fucking phrase, I always thought of fucking George Takei saying balloon knot on the Stern
Oh,
show.
God.
That's all I thought of. I couldn't help myself. Every fucking time. I think that's a silly name for a fucking set of villains. But this is when the true knot surround her. And this is the teaser which opens this movie. How do we like the setup?
I love how the true knot, they move like a flock of birds.
Mm-hmm.
And the director's cut, this scene is pretty much identical, except they show in the campground, you see the RVs moving in the background prior to the actual introductions. So I like that in the director's cut, they're establishing the RVs are like their main course of transportation. Because in the theatrical cut, they just kind of pop up behind Rose. I like that kind of foreshadowing in the director's cut. And for the most part, let me say the director's cut in general, it is 30 minutes longer. A lot of it is extended scenes, but there are a couple of big things that I wish were in the theatrical cut. And I get it. This movie's already 2.5 hours. With the director's cut, it's a little over 3. So I get why things were cut down. Most of them are pretty take it or leave it, but I think there are at least a couple things that I'm like, I really wish they included that.
Wow, that's interesting, because at this 2.5 hours, there are things I would definitely take out, but we'll definitely get to
you
that.
You know,
Adam,
to me, the problem with this is it sets up, I mean, because this is, right here is actually pretty suspenseful horror scene that I don't think it's matched for the rest of the movie. It sets a tone right here that it just can't compete with later. I mentioned before, you know, how do you do the hedge animals? You do it just like this. They're there. They're closer. They're closer. They're closer. I mean, the knot, when they show up and it's fucking frightening, that's how you do hedge animals. It's just like Flanagan did this fucking group. They're not moving. They're just standing there. There's one. There's three.
Yeah.
There's five. And then they're suddenly on her. Oh, fuck, it works. But he never hits this height, I don't think, the rest of the movie, in the way of a scary, oh, shit kind of scene.
There's definitely a scene later that definitely matches this, if not far exceeds it. But we'll get to that. But what I'll say to what you said, Adam, is that I don't think this movie's frightening. I don't think
it's
this movie's scary.
Movie.
I think, no, it's not. There are disturbing elements to it, and we'll definitely get to one of the most disturbing things he's ever done later. But as a movie, you don't have a sense of dread over your head like you do in that original Shining.
No,
that's what he sets up.
And then from somebody right here going in, the music cues, the strings, the time frame. From an outsider viewer, to a lot of King stuff, it at least let me know, and I was really fucking surprised not knowing the history of this movie. I was like, holy shit, we're actually going to sequelize Kubrick's Shining with some King elements, and that blew me away. Like, I could not fucking believe that, but I was happy to go that route instead.
So, two points I'll add. One is what it lacks in scares, as far as what Adam was talking about with nothing topping this, it makes up for with one of the thematic cruxes of the movie is the cycle of, child endangerment and child abuse that runs blatant throughout this entire movie. So I like that this is not just child murder for the sake of it. And as far as the Kubrickization and the director's cut, there's both title cards. It's broken up into six chapters. And Flanagan actually uses a lot of cross-dissolves in the director's cut to transition from scenes to make it more indebted to Kubrick's movie. And also, you see the Overlook in the director's cut as one of the opening title cards for Chapter 3. They pan across the ballroom. It says Chapter 3. So the director's cut, it's more indebted to the Kubrick movie than this is. Given how the final act of this movie is constructed, I feel like that would have been more of a necessity, and I wish those were kept in the theatrical cut.
We cut to a reenactment of a scene that we have seen before. Danny driving his big wheel throughout the hotel, and then stopping at room 237, not 217, where a ghostly image awaits him. This is when he wakes up and is met by a woman who, by the way, looks and acts absolutely nothing like Shelley Duvall.
I could not believe they went this route.
Pretty, like I said, dude, the balls on this dude, very ballsy to go this route, honest to God. You're going to evoke images like this. You're going to have this woman act like Shelley Duvall. We're going to get Dick Halloran here in a little bit. Like, you're making those you're going to make those comparisons happen. Yep. She begs Danny to talk to her, and then we cut to Danny having a conversation with Halloran. And here's an example of the line that Flanagan had to walk, right? Because in the book, Halloran is alive and well. And in the Dr. Sleep book, this is a conversation Danny actually has with Halloran as they all vacation in Florida together. But here, since Kubrick killed Halloran in his version, this is Danny having a conversation with a fucking force ghost that is interrupted by Wendy. I hate that he had to do this. And by the way, the guy playing Halloran is once again nothing like a cinematic counterpart. I feel none of the warmth from this guy that Scatman had in his version. This is, he's about 20, 25 years younger. Right away, I'm very turned off.
I agree with you. It's a fine line to walk, and I thought this is when they might be kind of juxtaposing the two different versions of Shining that we had together. And I thought that this meant that Dick was still alive in this version until Wendy shows up here, but it changes the rules that we've seen about ghosts, and it becomes very problematic for me later on in this film because, okay, Dick died at the Overlook. So is he not in the Overlook? Is he not taken over by the Overlook? The rules change based on what they want to have happen, not what's been established. And I go with the movie as a sense of enjoyment, but when I try to break those parts down, it kind of pisses me off.
This will be an animated discussion because I disagree with both of you. I really like Carl Laemmle as Dick Halloran. Let me say this.
I like him as Dick. I just have a problem with what they're doing with Dick, but I think he plays Dick fine.
I give Flanagan so much respect for casting actors and not doing the stupid, deep fake de-aging crap that both Marvel and Rogue One have done. Mm-hmm. Because that takes me out considerably more. I actually thought Wendy physically doesn't look 100%, but the voice is very, like when she yells Danny off camera, I found it startlingly close.
She's got a rundown. I'll give her that. When she's running towards him, like, you definitely think that's Shelley Duvall. But other than that, like,
I always appreciate when you get actors who match the physicality and the speech impediments. Because the example I always use is Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs. Doesn't look like him. Probably doesn't sound like him. But he embodies the spirit of who that guy was. And that's what I feel like all these actors do. Let me preface by saying three of the four that they recreate. Danny, kids are a lot harder to cast, but I buy this kid as a young Danny Torrance. There's one person who's recast that does take me out.
Oh,
process elimination. You all can guess who it is. But I think this works a lot. Yeah. And the director's cut, this scene is about 2 minutes longer with him and Dick, where he talks about how, like, your dad was not a bad person. He just had, like, demons he couldn't, that were magnified by the hotel. You're right about the playing loose with the rules, but that's why Kubrick was smart to keep it ambiguous. Mm-hmm. I don't know how this Force Ghost shit works, but honestly, I don't care, because it's, they're setting up the rules early in this movie, or at least this, but I don't like the later on, oh, I'm going to pull a Yoda from Return of the Jedi, and this is the last time you and I are going to see each other. Like, what the fuck is that shit?
This is when Danny is told about the mind box trick, the way of trapping the mean spirits. You know, this would have been nice to know when he was a kid. Like, you're going to bring this up now? Fucking like bullshit. Obi-Wan.
Oh, by the way, you have a sister.
Yeah. Oh, boy. And then at the very end of this, I do like the way Flanagan pans out and we see the missing poster for Violet, the girl from the beginning, hanging on a post. I thought that was very nicely done. So Danny and Wendy, they're watching Looney Tunes on TV when Danny is again visited by Mrs. Massey. And he just walks in and traps her. Boom. Done. Next. That's it. That's all we get. How great would this have done? See, this is what I thought this was going to be when I heard about the context of this film. With the exception of the vampires, which we'll get to, but how great would it have been? To me, we see this character struggle with the alcoholism because he is still being stalked by the ghost from this hotel. Mrs. Massey is still stalking him. That would have been the movie to me. That would have been, oh, now I see what this character is struggling with. I don't think trapping these ghosts at the beginning of this story does any good to anybody. Yeah, you're doing the fanfic thing of you're seeing what you loved before. Now they're going away, and boom, done. And this is the way it's done in the book, too, by the way. He gets this out of the way. You know, Mrs. Massey does visit Danny at the beginning of that thing, and we do get this scene pretty much the way Flanagan outlines it here. But to me, this does nothing. This does absolutely nothing.
See, this is where I think the director's cut improves. You talk about how, like, he's an alcoholic. Like, he seems like he's conquered his demons. Why would he, you know, be such a drunk? In the director's cut, the scene where he talks to Lloyd, quote-unquote, he talks about how his mom couldn't look him in the eye because all she saw was his father. And I think knowing that is what drove him to drink, that, like, it really is hereditary and the horror doesn't stay at the hotel. Like, you can put all the boxes, you can put all the monsters in boxes, but the true monster is, like, your what you carry from your parents. I wish that was more kept in this cut, because I think that would have possibly alleviated some of your concerns about him using these boxes and emphasize more that it's because his mom and him just couldn't get over what happened. And, like, it put a permanent disconnect between the two of them.
And in the book, by the way, you know, Wendy's still suffering the consequences. Like, here she's running around like she's just fine. In the book, she still has big, big back problems due to what Jack did to her. So we're not seeing any of that here. You know, so I'm not even feeling that she has any after effects, really. This is all Danny's story. And that's a problem for me as well.
You know, I think Wendy probably had back problems from Shelley Duvall carrying that original movie. Sorry, that was out of nowhere. That Danny's being haunted away from the Overlook was a weird decision for me, because I never got the sense that when Dick went down to Florida that he was still going to be visited by these ghosts. So I didn't understand that part of it. But again, this is quick. It's the only thing that this does is set up the end of the movie. So, bam, he's got boxes. Would have been nice to fucking know this before, kid. Sorry. You know, maybe before I let you stay in a fucking haunted house for 6 months, I would have explained this to you since I obviously knew it. But you brought it up. It's replaying the hit. So you get to see it. And I kind of appreciated seeing it before because, again, it lets me know where this movie's going. It's walking that fine line of something different, but hey, we're going to show you what you came for, which is that original Shining, and just that fear from Danny and Wendy. This is when I do feel that Wendy encapsulates that original Shelley Duvall. It works for me, but I know that all it is to set up the end of the movie. There's no fucking suspense there. All these are coming out later.
We then see Danny wake up in present day, looking a hell of a lot like Obi-Wan Kenobi. Now, this is, of course, Ewan McGregor. And this was a casting I was looking forward to seeing because this character struggles with his addiction. And people know that Ewan McGregor himself has had his own addiction problems. And he said he was willing to attack this role because he wanted to put some of his own problems into this character. I don't feel that in this movie. I don't feel he is good in this movie at all. But this could come from the fact that Jack Torrance was such an interesting character given all the struggles that he had. Danny, in both the book and film, just comes off as a bland king protagonist. And McGregor does nothing interesting with the material.
You know what? I kind of disagree with you there. Not even kind of. I disagree quite a bit. I like Ewan McGregor in this a lot, but I think he's a good actor. My issue right off the bat is Danny's not an interesting character at the beginning of Danny Adult. Isn't an interesting character. He's just an asshole and a piece of shit as a person. And then it drops fairly quickly off. I like what Ewan does with the material. I just don't think it's written all that well, maybe, but I like Ewan here in it. I don't think that if somebody else was doing this role, I would have enjoyed it.
I'm with Adam 100%. I think Ewan McGregor's fantastic in this movie. And for a guy who's as good-looking as he is, he doesn't have as many leading roles as you think he should. Which is because he could have very easily gone the Hugh Grant route of, I'm just going to make rom-coms where I don't get to touch myself.
Yeah.
I think here he's very good. But one thing that I think the director Scott does do better is emphasize his rock bottom moment.
Okay.
And drives the...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, all things being equal, I think he does as good a job as possible with this character, who really, the biggest problem with this movie, and probably the book, is he's not the main character. So calling it Dr. Sleep is kind of disingenuous.
You mentioned the rock bottom moment. Now, when King showed his son, Joe Hill, who, by the way, is also a writer, the first draft of this manuscript, his son said what Danny needs is that moment where he feels like he hits rock bottom. Because King didn't have that moment. And this is when King came up with the scene of Danny sleeping with this MILF he meets at a bar and stealing $70 from her wallet after throwing up in a toilet. I'm sorry, this is not rock bottom. This is not Jack breaking Danny's arm or slapping George around for slashing his tires. This is far from hopeless, and honestly, I thought King was better than this. Adam, you said that he just comes off as an asshole. Yeah, he's an asshole, but is this really rock bottom? I don't think so.
Yeah, these are uncomfortable scenes for me. They don't play well in this. Like, I don't enjoy watching them. It's not setting up a sense of dread. I don't like Danny at this point. And maybe I'm not supposed to, but I don't even not like him in an enjoyable way. This is not a way to get us to remember that sweet boy from the first movie. Mm. And you would think with everything that he had fucking gone through, you know, and I know that trauma is personal, trauma is individual, but you would think that something like that, I don't know, you think the person that it would be grown up to would be different than just being a fucking darker mirror of his father.
I'm so tired of fucking arguing with you guys.
we're not even 20 minutes in.
I think the point the director's cut drives this home, it's not the fact that he steals the money, it's that he knowingly leaves that kid to die.
The kid. Yeah.
Because he asks the kid in the director's cut, what's your name? And they talk for a little bit. So I think it's knowing that is what sort of is the rock bottom moment. I don't think it's stealing the money. I think it's that. This might as well be a sequel to Trainspotting.
Thank you.
It's the actual Trainspotting sequel.
But here's the thing. Like, yeah, it could be, but we see this. We see him go to AA, boom, done, over. We don't see him struggle with this. That's my issue. Yeah, we see him throw up here for a few minutes. That's it. We meet Billy Freeman. We meet all these other characters. And that's the end of the struggle with addiction. Okay, towards the end, yeah, they try reawakening that by redoing that scene from the first Shining. We'll get to that. But at this point, I don't see this character struggling. I see him being, like Adam said, an asshole. But if you're saying that he goes to the kid and asks him, you know, what's your name and everything, that would have helped, I think. But I'm not seeing any of that inner struggle of this character. We then cut to Rose the Hat sitting next to Crow Daddy as they watch Andy seduce a man using her sleeping powers. Now, in a film that is, in my mind, already too long, did we really need to see the initiation of a character that is merely part of the group and not an integral part of the story?
Yes.
Okay. Defend it, both of you, because I don't see the need for this scene.
because you need to get some context as to who the Truna actually are. And I think showing an initiation works because, again, the theatrical cut basically leaves it as they are vampires seeking immortality. And they just kill kids with the shine because they're a threat and they're a life force. I think this, with the Andy character, reinforces that Rose can have different tactics for who she wants in the group. And there's a scene in the director's cut later on where that point is driven home even further with Abra, because the big question is why don't they just kill her? Like, immediately?
Mm-hmm.
So it's balanced off a bit. And this scene's even longer in the director's cut.
Oh.
We're seeing different kinds of psychic abilities because this Andy can just, like, possess people and put them to sleep. I wonder if that's irony on the Dr. Sleep title as well.
Maybe.
Yeah, for me, it's not only do I need this here to show me what's going on, I would have actually preferred throughout this movie maybe two or three minute scenes of seeing how the True Knot got together. I think they owed us showing them capturing the magic children throughout centuries. I think could have been a little more developed than what we have, because I don't, is it only kids with a shine? Since everybody's fucking magic now in every fucking town across the world, is it just the shine? Is it only a certain kind of magic? Is there just a myriad of individuals throughout everywhere that has the ability that they've hunted down? I think that the Knot actually should have been fleshed out a little more, and some of the other shit could have been cut out of this movie in its wake instead.
Yeah, they're pretty much X-Men, aren't they? Like, they all have different abilities.
You know what? They're the new mutants at the end of fucking Logan. They all show up with different things in the woods.
By the way, in the book, this character is 30 years old. Here, Flanagan made her 15. I guess she's already angry at men in this. But in the book, it's more established that she's had 30 years of being very angry at men, and this is how she lashes out. We then cut to a birthday party where abracadabra is uttered, and this is where the other protagonist of the film, known only as Abra, is introduced. This is straight from the book, and in my mind, yet another scene that should have been cut. I don't want to see this chick with the spoons up on the ceiling. I don't want to see any of this. I think this is Flanagan being slavish to the material. I think he is trying his best to adhere to both parties. I think he's trying to adhere to the Master King right here. And I don't think this does anything to build character. Not to me. We could have seen this girl struggle with her inner demons as well and not have this scene with these spoons up that, yeah, it's kind of cute, but what other purpose does it serve?
Her introduction is different in the director.
Oh, okay. What's her introduction?
She's introduced. She goes to bed, and she's playing the piano from her bed.
Oh.
And the parents are like, what the fuck is going on? And there's also a conversation between her and the mom where she's like, you're scared of me, aren't you? So that gives you the sense that she is purposely keeping her shining dormant because she doesn't want to hurt anybody, which makes the scene with her and Danny, where Danny tells her lay low, all the more like of a betrayal on her part. So again, one of those scenes that, yeah, it sounds minor when I explain it, but it really, that should have been her introduction. Ironically, axed this one.
Wow, I thought you were going to come after me, and you actually, wow, that I'm shocked that you actually went with that, because I really did not like this scene.
To me, it feels like they've taken something that would have been in Carrie and inserted it here.
Oh, yeah.
So it just, I don't feel it's unique enough for Abra. And first of all, King, to say that you came up with the name Abra and did not fucking tie it to abracadabra, you are a lying fucking piece of shit. About so many things, but bullshit. You got called out on it, and you tried to deny it, you asshole. I don't mind it, but for him to say, oh, I had no idea I did that. Dick.
And he doesn't have the excuse nowadays of saying, I was on drugs.
Yeah. He's not typing up these fucking manuscripts with cotton balls up his nose like he used to. Yeah, and by the way, in the book also, this is a little blonde-haired chick. She's a little white blonde-haired chick. So that's another change that Flanagan made that I think is for the better. I like this chick a lot. I like what she does with this role a lot. But again, I think she has the problem. Well, I guess we'll get to the problem I have with her later. But I think the girl, as for the most part, plays it well. I just don't like the intro that they give here. And according to Matt, that director's cut actually sounds a little bit better.
Yeah, I like her casting quite a bit. I think she's a really good addition.
Yeah, I think she's a future star.
Never seen her. I think this was her first
was
movie.
It? Wow. So Ro starts feeling Abra's energy as she talks to who will be known as Snakebite Andy. And now I'm going to reveal this right now. Matt, do you know the connection Abra has to the Torrance family?
Play the deck.
No.
No, I read this, so I know. That's who.
In this movie.
Call it tap feet, because they fucking stretch.
In this movie, Abra is somebody who has a connection to Danny just because of the shine that they share. In the book, King narrows the Shining universe down like fucking George Lucas, because he makes Abra the result of an affair that Jack had with her grandmother. So
they basically pulled the Rage Carry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I thought of too. That's exactly what I thought.
Yep.
So she is the niece of Danny in that book. Fucking ridiculous. You don't need that. Oh my God.
Thankfully, that's not here. No. Thank God that's not here. Whatsoever.
And you know what? And yes, I've been hard on this movie, but I am going to spend a lot of this podcast praising Flanagan for the small instances that he changed from book to screen. This is one of them. Thank God he took this fucking out. And there's one other thing he took out, by the way.
Is there a kid orgy in this one too?
No. On September 11th, 2001.
God damn it.
Abra is screaming as a little girl while the True Knot.
Oh, that's right.
Head to New Jersey and take in all the steam from people who died in the towers.
Stephen King, you're a fucking piece of shit as a person.
I don't, you know what? I don't think King's a piece of shit. I'm going to say that I don't think he's a piece of shit. I don't think he means to demean anybody or anything, any past event. I don't think he means that. He's trying to tell a story and he's trying to make it connect to a real world. I have no issues with him as a person, really. But I do have issues with this fucking connection, because it's just, it does come off as in poor taste. And that's another thing I'm glad Flanagan took out.
Does he also talk about how they camped outside of Auschwitz?
Right? Shit, that would make sense if you fucking showed one or two of them as fucking Nazis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing about it is, and Flanagan doesn't go into what these characters are, what the True Knot are. In that book, these characters are hundreds of years old. They have this steam to keep themselves looking young and make themselves look vibrant. And that's how they're able to travel the world. They're millionaires. They're flat-out millionaires. And they're able to travel the
world. Oh, great. It's Twilight.
Yeah, pretty much. For all the shit he gives Twilight, that's exactly what they are.
Like, that is literally the family in Twilight. Uh-huh.
And so they're able to travel the world, and this is how they get all the steam to keep themselves up and going. So when 9/11 happened, that's when they just went over there, and they just took in all that steam. So that's a way to explain it. I get it, but you don't put that in. And, ooh, boy. I got to that part in the book, and I was like, I had to fucking write this down, because there's no fucking way. All right, so we cut to Danny getting off a bus in Fraser, New Hampshire. He's just kind of walking around while that heartbeat that the soundtrack keeps thudding. I do like that Flanagan keeps that in. I thought that was a nice touch. And we meet Cliff Curtis's character, Billy Freeman. Matt, we keep having to review this guy.
Well, he's in fucking everything, because he plays every race imaginable.
Yes.
He is the casting director equivalent of a Kiwi. He does whatever you need him to be. Yeah. It's unfortunate that the first time we talked about him was fucking Last Airbender. Thankfully, this is a better showcase. Although, I will say, I have this complaint about small town Stephen King in general, is that people are not this nice. Like there comes a point where it's not believable. Like, this guy might as well be a mystical magical Negro. Like, he might as well be Morgan. He might as well be like Will Smith from Bagger Vance.
Oh, Jesus. You went Will Smith and Bagger Vance. I don't think anybody in the history of man has made that reference. Good going, dude. Billy pays for the first 2 weeks of an $85 a week apartment, one that conveniently has a blackboard. And Billy tells Danny the reason he is doing this is because he knows the look and he gets feelings about people. So, here we go.
So, somebody watched, I swear to God, I thought of fucking Dark Knight Rises. Oh, yeah. He's like, I knew you were Batman because I saw the look.
Oh, my God. Like, we cut to the full initiation of Snakebite Andy, and it is here where we are first introduced to steam, which is the energy force these vampire types need to survive. You know, I had mentioned that I felt Dr. Sleep was one of my least favorite books of King's bibliography. This steam conceit, it reminded me of the main plot point of another King stinker of a book, and one that I hope to God is never made into a book called Insomnia. And I seem to remember a similar life force being in that one, although it was called Aura in that and not Steam. This Steam, while it plays like it plays an integral part of what comes later, is kind of silly. Why don't we just have this be blood?
Yeah, we don't want to become literal vampires. That's the only reason. Yeah.
Yep, agreed. I mean, we trade it out, and instead we get, I mean, it's literally like watching Life Force without the booze.
Another fucking reference.
But it's the exact same effect.
It is. Yeah, it's a good point.
I do like the device where she keeps them in, like, thermoses. I like that they have, like, storage tanks.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty inventive. But the... You're right. The making steam a literal personification of the life force that psychics give off came off as a little hackneyed, but let's be honest, Stephen King has one weakness as a writer. He's got a few as far as tropes I don't like. He's never had a good grasp on psychics personifying it, especially like this in Dreamcatcher.
Oh, Dreamcatcher. Yeah, boy, that's one I cannot wait to talk about.
This is better than shit weasels, but...
I just want to see some differentiation in the psychics. I mean, fuck, just wait till we get to Firestarter and it's the same fucking trope all over again.
Yeah.
Dead Zone, also psychics. Like, it's in a lot of it's in a lot of his work. I'll be amazed if, like, how this guy had never got in touch with Chris Claremont blows my mind.
Danny is visited by the spirit of the woman who he stole the money from, who tells him that they haven't found them yet, meaning her and her son. I will admit this is kind of creepy, although I felt this kid looked kind of, the dummy that they made of him was kind of weird looking. Again, Flanagan's so good at building these kinds of scenes and giving you these flashes of fright. And I thought this was a pretty well done scene.
Yeah, to me the scene works well, but it also, this should have been his rock bottom moment, is seeing that leaving them there meant they both died in that bed. Because to me that's what this was. The scene works well, the effect... To me, it looks like the fucking miniseries on TV, because I don't think the makeup is all that good. But it caught me out of nowhere, and it was kind of it gave me the willies. I'll say that. It worked.
Yeah, the only difference between this and Trainspotting is that it doesn't crawl on the ceiling.
Danny goes to an AA meeting with Billy, a meeting run by Jill from Jill's Game himself, Mr. Bruce Greenwood. Danny tells the doctor that he knows the location of his watch, given that he was worried about the kid that had Gutcher's disease, and he tells him to check on the soap dispenser. But this is the one AA meeting we see him attend. You know, that's what was so odd about this.
Yeah. And then
why are you also outing yourself this way?
Yes.
Well, and then it cuts to 8 years later, which makes it even, I don't want to call it insulting, but to gloss over 8 years of alcohol rehabilitation in a movie that's already very long, I would have liked to have seen maybe a couple relapses or like he turns to God. I don't know what he would do, but I think his overcoming the demons, that comes off as he does that way too easily for my taste.
Was it 8 years?
Yeah, because it cuts to 8 years later when he's giving that speech.
Yeah. Oh, fuck, you're right.
Yeah. Danny tells the doctor that he wants to do something better than what he's been doing, and the doctor offers him a job at the hospice care center. And this, to me, is the most interesting part of this movie. Danny communicating with all these people who are about to die, all of these things about cats that are around every time someone dies. And by the way, this was an idea King had for a separate story, where he had read an article about a cat at a hospice care center that would go to the people who, as they were about to die. And people did not realize, what did this cat see that made him go to them? And he was going to play with that a little bit, and he decided to put this in this story. In my mind, this is totally showing my hand, but I could have done without them going back to the Overlook and had an interesting story revolve everything that happens here. This stuff at the hospice care center, especially given I have seen relatives die in front of me, and so I know the emotion that's behind all of this. Like this, they could have played with this, and it just becomes a part where he gets named Dr. Sleep, and that's pretty much it.
This is an instance where you can tell this idea stemmed from another book entirely. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, I like these moments a lot because these are the warmest parts of the movie, and I think McGregor plays these very well. And Flanagan plays these well because this could have been a Spielberg level of sentimentality. And I like the conversations that he has with the one guy where he's like, you know, there was nothing before, what if there's nothing after? And he doesn't quite know how to answer that. I think these scenes work a lot, and sort of like what you said, I wish they were a bigger component of this story.
Yeah, I agree with both of you there. These scenes hooked me. I think it's a great showcase for Ewan. They seem to have, I mean, in the movie, they seem to have no purpose other than to give him the name. But being that, I mean, he's a fucking ghost whisperer now. Apparently his shine kind of changes. He can turn it on and off when he wants. I would have liked a little explanation that way. But you agreed. You could have really said it here for the crux of it. And even, I mean, not to be disrespectful, but played into these kind of nursing homes that aren't necessarily the best. I thought that the doctor that hires him, Bruce Greenwood, like I thought he was going to be a villain overall in this. I didn't think he was going to be a good guy throughout. Instead, we just get him as a fucking cameo.
Yeah.
To show that original office from Kubrick's Shining. So I thought we were going to have more. But I agree with both of you, really could have been I like the scenes, and I think they could have done more here. But I like what we do get.
Danny talks to somebody who was worried about dying because of the cat that won't leave his side, and this is when Danny is given the name Dr. Sleep. Not that that comes into play at all, but that's how he gets his name. Danny sees hello written on the blackboard, so he decides to write hi back, much to Abra's delight. You know, given that we see this landlord that comes in and she seems to be a real hard ass, I thought this was going to play too, where like he was going to get his ass mm-hmm. kicked out or something for doing all this on this blackboard, but we don't see any of that either. Is there any of that in the director's cut, Matt?
No, and it doesn't answer my big question. Why is there no kitchen in that?
Yeah. I was thinking that too. By the way, this whole psychically writing back and forth, both on this blackboard and other parts of the story, were a huge part of the book and a big reason why I didn't like it. I don't like when people have these psychic connections and that's how they're communicating. But it happens so much in that book. Luckily, Flanagan does it a little bit, but not that much. He does enough to move the story along, and that's it, which, again, is a sleight of hand by him that I completely respect. Danny then goes up to AA and mentions his dad in the darkness the thought of him brings. That's right, I forgot about this part too in the AA meetings. So this is also setting up the end, right, guys? This whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Crow Daddy. Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, I was just going to say the director's cut is a little longer. He talks about how when he got his arm broken.
Okay.
He talks about how, like, you know, my dad did some heinous things. Like, he broke my arm, but I know it wasn't. It's almost like he's in denial as to how much of a monster his father actually was, which is kind of contradictory to the Kubrick version. I think that's the one area where it kind of struggles. It's like he doesn't know which Jack are we talking about. Are we talking about the one for the book? Are we talking about Jack Nicholson?
Yeah, and that's what's weird because, you know, and that's a problem I have with the material in general, and this goes to the source material, is that King seems to have a lot of sympathy towards Jack, and this is a guy who is a complete dick. And, yeah, the sympathy doesn't go very far. And he tries playing that up in this book. And Flanagan kind of does that a little bit in this scene in this movie. And, yeah, you need to play up the fact that this guy ended up actually almost killing you. So
to me, it's always been, though, that Jack is king. You know, yeah. Jack Torrance is Stephen King. It's his stand-in for himself. So I don't think he's ever going to let him be inherently evil because – he would admit that to himself. You know, it's the alcohol, it's not me. So Jack as a person has got to be good because the demon is the bottle.
Great point. Crow Daddy meets up with Rose the Hat and tells her that they need more steam. And this is a huge reason why, and they explain this in the book and not really in the movie, that their numbers are low. It's because the more people they have in their group, the more steam they have to distribute amongst themselves. So they have to keep their numbers low. All right, here we go. So we then cut to Jacob Tremblay, who's playing a character of Bradley Trevor, a little leaguer who is picked up by the True Knot. And remember how I said, and Matt also said, there was one scene from both the book and movie that gave me that sense of dread that I come to expect in this universe?
Oof.
This is it. What makes this scene so harrowing, and the only thing that I like about this scene, is the longer the victim suffers and is in pain, the more steam the victim produces. So they make this kid suffer so they can get every ounce of steam they can out of him. Couple things here. One, it's ironic that Rebecca Ferguson is in this movie because one of her rules of thumb when doing movies is she will not be in a movie that has violence towards kids. But she's a big fan of both Flanagan and King, and she did decide to do this, although according to Flanagan, this was such a tough scene to film for everybody. But she plays this very well. Another thing is I just rewatched Room, which is a very good movie, one that Brie Larson won the Oscar for. Mm-hmm. Watching that movie again, I see that the wrong person got that statue. This kid is amazing in that movie. He's amazing in this movie. He plays suffering so well that Flanagan was legitimately worried while shooting this scene. He thought this kid was really hurting. Sure enough, as soon as he yelled cut, Tremblay got up and went to the craft table because he was starving, and he went to go grab a sandwich. but this is just, it's a painful scene to both watch and read, but in both instances, it comes off remarkably well, and that's a huge compliment I'm giving this movie.
It's been a long time since I've been this uncomfortable and squeamish watching a movie. Not just horror, like I'm talking anything whatsoever. This kid will win an Oscar one day, I guarantee it. He is the closest thing I've seen to Haley Joel Osment in a considerable amount of time. Hopefully he doesn't have the issues that Osment ran into later in his life. But yeah, it's amazing that this is as harrowing as it is without feeling overly gratuitous. I think in lesser hands, this would have just been like borderline tasteless schlock. Yeah. And yeah, the director's cut, it's even longer.
Oh, no.
She even has a line after she kills him. She's like, I thought he had more shine in him. But yeah, I love that as soon as they yelled cut, he's like, all right, good job, everybody. Sorry I traumatized you all.
This scene is so fucking disturbing. And this kid, oh, wow. He absolutely brings it. Yeah, going back to my comment at the beginning. Didn't say that it was the best scene. I just thought it was going to – I didn't think anything was going to match that in the way of dread. In the way of a fucking horror scene, Matt, you said it. This is – uncomfortable, and this may be my most uncomfortable thing that I've watched in so long, and I also couldn't tear away. Ferguson talks about how it got done, like she had to leave the set for a bit. She was in tears because of just how authentic he made the scene feel, and we feel that too. This kid's gonna do some special things, but in here, from a peak of bringing that horror element, this is the one horror scene that just, I mean, this torture is fucking uncomfortable, and it works because of that, and it only works because of his performance. It's spectacular.
It was also, his role was not publicized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I know when he showed up in the movie, I'm like, why is he here? And then when someone told me afterwards that this was in the book, I'm like, oh, that's why you get an actor of his caliber for such a small scene. And this kid, much like Rebecca Ferguson, has starred in one of my favorite bad movies of the last 10 years, The Book of Henry.
Oh, he was in that?
If you have not seen that, he plays the younger brother. And if anyone has not seen that, please go out and watch The Book of Henry. You will hate it, but you will be in sheer admiration of what you are watching.
That's a great way of putting that.
You know, it's funny because to me, what he does, he plays my favorite comic book character. He plays Damian Wayne in the Harley Quinn animated series.
So the agony that this kid feels is being seen and felt by Abra, which stops both Danny and Rose the Hat in their tracks. And, of course, this is also the way that murder comes back into Danny's life, as it is written on the blackboard, along with Baseball Boy. And when it's reflected in the mirror, what's it say? Red rum. Boom.
I like that it's the inverse of it.
Yeah. Yeah, good call.
That it's murder, you know, that he's seeing murder and it's red, you know, that it's just flipped. It's a nice little homage that he made his own.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was the first blatant one that I was like, you're leaning too close to the Kubrick side there, if you ask me.
Yeah, it felt a little fan service-y, didn't it?
Yeah, although you could say that about the last half hour too, which we'll get into.
Oh yeah, definitely. So the True Knot, they bury the boy as Rose warns that they have a looker from the East Coast. Abra tells her mom that she's made a new friend named Dan. As her mother asks her if she's okay, she starts hearing voices in the library as she starts looking up missing kids on the internet. She lays back in her bed with a picture of Bradley Trevor in her hand, and we hear the heartbeat again, and she starts convulsing and having flashes of what exactly happened to him. She flies to her window and lands right in the head of Rose the Hat as she's going shopping, and this chick is so powerful, she pushes Rose away. This is like making Rey so powerful in the Force Awakens, right? This is the girl I'm supposed to be rooting for. She's already fucking extremely strong. Why am I rooting for this chick to win this shit?
Yeah, she's stronger than it. You know, we get told before Danny was, you know, never seen anybody shine like you can, Danny. And are we discussing shining? Are we discussing telepathy? She can read other people's thoughts, but she can also do this. I mean, part of it is the King ill-defining his own fucking world and own powers. Mm-hmm. I like seeing them face off because I think it's going to be these two facing off. Like, I think Danny's dead. I think they're going to be killing him off, and it's going to be these two facing off in the end. I like it, but I thought maybe we were in her mind at first where I realized that Rose the Hat's just fucking going grocery shopping, which I thought was a weird decision to show her there. But I like the using the freezer as a mirror just because we've seen mirrors matter so many times in the Shining world. But I like that these two are going to be the ones to face off.
Hmm. Was I the only one getting Nightmare on Elm Street flashbacks with the giant filing cabinet?
Yep.
And the closing on her arm, which Mike Flanagan's got a thing for breaking people's hands in disgusting ways.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a scene where I'm actually going to talk about here a little bit. Adam, so this is a movie that you hadn't seen before this viewing. You're coming off The Shining. We're a little more than an hour in at this point. What are you feeling at this point? Like, this isn't the movie you expected. Are you enjoying what you're seeing? Are you kind of waiting for it to end? Is it dragging? What's going on in your mind at this point?
A couple of both. It's dragging because I think the writing itself isn't as crisp as it should be. And I don't know if this got rushed to get it to screen because of some shit that was going on, but it doesn't flow. There's good scenes that the tangential connections to go from one to the other aren't as smooth as I would like. The actors and the performances are keeping me going, but the drive of the story isn't what's keeping me engaged. And there's parts where I'm just kind of tuning out a little bit until, you know, parts of it suck me back in, specifically Ferguson and the young woman that plays Abra.
Matt, what about you? You all in?
Pretty close. I should say I've seen I understand the complaint that this would have been better as like a Netflix miniseries, but I think the director's cut alleviates some of the pacing issues because scenes have more time to breathe, and the title cards help it out a lot because they provide good points to break if you absolutely have to. But even with the theatrical cut, I'm on board with this pretty close to 100%. Like, I don't have the issues that you guys do.
Rose warns Crow Daddy that Abra is indeed as powerful as they had foreseen. Because we...
Oh, God. All right. So this scene, the director's cut.
Uh-oh.
She has a line where Crow Daddy says, like, why don't we just kill her? And she says something very smart. She goes, think about it. You kill a cow for meat. It lasts you, what, a month? You drug up a cow and use it for milk. It lasts you a lifetime.
And that's from the book. That's line for line.
I like that perspective would have helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me, because that's my issue. It's like, why don't you just kill her? And I half expected Ewan McGregor to say, like, when they finally meet, your midichlorian count is so much higher than I ever thought possible. Because like this movie, they talk about Shine like it's the Force.
I know. Yeah, she's floating. Absolutely. I got a lot of flashes back to that. And X-Men, as I mentioned earlier.
And I don't like that Rose steals his line of, hello there.
Oh, boy. Danny meets up with Abra and tells her that in this day and age, maybe he shouldn't be sitting this close to her on a park bench. As Abra tells Danny of what the True Knot is trying to do. Meanwhile, Dick appears. Here he comes. Dick is back. He appears to Danny and pretty much tells him to pay a debt that he's missing. And Abra is so powerful that she forces Rose the Hat to smash her hand in a drawer, which you mentioned earlier, Matt.
Oh. Hey, time out.
Okay.
Because we learn later that Uncle Dan has to travel a pretty big distance to go to Abra. But she shows up here on the park bench in a few hours, it seems. But I can't tell if it was a projection, was it not? I'm like, okay, she's projecting herself. But no, she's really there. But that time frame does not fucking add up later when he's got to travel day and night to go to fucking get her. It seemed like they were on opposite areas of the country.
All right, I have a lot of issues with this movie, but the continuity is not one of them.
Okay.
So I didn't think about it.
Maybe I missed something.
As a counterpoint, this is a movie that exists in the universe where a 13-year-old girl can get a bus ticket to the other side of the country and nobody can win.
Because I kept showing her, like, in mirrors, you know, in the reflection in the glass. So I literally thought she was fucking Luke Skywalker Force ghost projecting herself out there onto the bench. Mm.
She was on her bed that's overseeing a sunset.
Grandpa Flick dies in a pretty weird little death scene. You know, one thing I want to mention here is, and I don't think they even talk about it in this movie, and I remember when I initially saw this in theaters, I initially thought maybe they had, but I didn't hear it mentioned. Maybe they mentioned it in the director's cut, Matt. But in the book, half of this true knot is not in the finale because one of the victims that they take has the measles. If you have the steam of somebody who has the measles or you're in an unvaccinated person, it completely eats you up from the inside, and it destroys their insides. So this dying of Grandpa here kind of reminded me of that, but I don't think I ever hear that mentioned in this movie. Is that ever mentioned?
That is never mentioned in the director's cut. They don't talk about, like, what happens if you, like, absorb a cancer patient or something. But I do like the way that they describe it as cycling.
Uh-huh.
Like, when they die, I like how just horrifying that is. I like how intense it is. But yeah, in the director's cut, those kind of conversations are not had.
All right. So we see Danny convince Billy to believe in him as Abra projects herself into the car they're riding in and becomes sort of their guide.
Jesus. She might as well be like,
I'm telling you. I'm telling you. I got a
Abra GPS.
They arm themselves up and just blow the true knot into fucking smithereens.
I love how we got a fucking, like, 80s shootout. This might as well be like the opening of Predator.
Oh my god.
So bizarre.
It does not mesh with the rest of the movie.
No, it doesn't.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that, like, because like I said, you know, in the book, is they're taken out by the measles. Here, Flanagan decided to put a whole fucking shootout in, and that's how he decides to take him out. Pretty bizarre little scene.
It's like the scene in The Patriot where Mel Gibson takes out all the British soldiers. It was like watching that.
I still haven't seen that movie, believe it or not.
That's right. I keep having to remind myself that you haven't seen it. But it's shot well. Like, I don't have any issues with the camera work or anything like that. It's just the... It feels so out of nowhere with the rest of the movie. Like, this is the equivalent of, like, if Cops showed up to the Overlook Hotel. obviously they would have shot Dick Halloran on sight.
Yeah. But you know what this is? This is Flanagan, again, compensating. Because instead of taking them all out with the measles, he decides to take them all out in the shootout. I don't know which one is better, honestly. I really don't, because, as you said, Matt, this scene is so out of context with the rest of this movie. Like, could you imagine, like, out of nowhere, like, Kubrick deciding to go into a fucking gunfight? You know? It's just... doesn't work.
I thought of... basically, the literalization of... there's a line in the It book when they go back as adults, and they go back into the sewer, and one of them goes, I don't suppose one of you brought anything useful like a machine gun.
You were able to pick out one line out of that 1,300 fucking page book. I'm shocked. Adam, this must have caught you off guard, huh?
Holy shit. I don't know what fucking movie we suddenly turned into.
I know.
But, yeah, I mean, it was just, as Matt said, you know, it's shot well, it's done well, it's staged well, but it does not feel like it has anything to do with the rest of this movie other than the actors in the fucking scene.
Mm-hmm.
One problem I do have with it is for these fucking vampires that they are, they're going to die like anybody or anything else. These aren't special bullets. These aren't blessed. They're not silver. So, and we see it again later. So the only thing that the steam does is just make them last longer. And I guess their supernatural, preternatural abilities that they can take it, but they're not fucking stronger than anything else. Like, it's funny that they could just, they're going to die just from a bullet. It seemed anticlimactic for what this group was.
I like that, actually, and it's specified by Rose in the director's cut, where after Grandpa Fleck dies, Andy's like, I thought you said we were immortal. She said, like, I promised you a longer life, not everlasting life.
Yeah, yep, and that was in, I caught that also. And I don't hate it. I was just kind of caught off guard by it. I was surprised that they wouldn't be a little more supernatural powered, you know, than just a longer life.
And by the way, Adam, you know what else? They don't burn up in sunlight. So, go right back to Twilight.
They have a little sparkle like a fucking diamond.
Yeah, there's no Wesley Snipes in a black trench coat and sunglasses taking these guys out.
But I do like the effects as they cycle through, you know, like Matt called out. Like, I do like what they look like as they're going through it, because it almost looks like they're going back through the stages that they've lived.
Mm-hmm. I did like the touch of right before Snakebite Andy dies, she convinces Billy to put the shotgun on his chin and kill himself. I thought that was kind of harrowing.
Oh, that was, fuck.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Dude, I mean, I was not expecting Billy to be collateral damage by the end of this. I've waited, how long have we been doing that? I waited 90 fucking minutes for that collateral damage joke. That fucking got me. That one broke my heart. I should have seen it coming. I really should have seen it coming, but goddamn, that one hurt.
Yeah. So in the skirmish, Crow Daddy takes Abra, and she is now a hostage. Danny comes up with the idea of heading to the Overlook, because this decade doesn't have enough nostalgia pieces. Now, before we talk about what happens here, let me just ask, Adam, in general, did you have any idea about this finale? And in general, do you like the finale?
I had no clue, because we'd stayed away from it mostly. You know, we got little hints and stuff. I had no idea we were going to go back to the Overlook. And I also got to mention, if there was one positive, gave a couple positives. But the shootout, from it being kind of all over the place, I utterly missed that Crow Daddy was not there.
Yeah.
And was very surprised when suddenly he showed up, stabbed Abra, and took her. So whatever that scene meant to do, it got me, because I completely forgot that he wasn't there with everybody else to die. But then as we get to the – I mean, I guess it makes sense, but other than, you know – Shower Lady, I don't feel like it. Everything either needed to happen at the Overlook or away from the Overlook. Because if it's that fucking important, that's where it should have been. And if it can traverse out through the rest of the fucking world, then it doesn't matter. So they kind of want to play both ends to it. I like what happens when we get to the Overlook, but it seems, I don't know, it seems disingenuous to the story that was being told.
So my question, as someone who has not read the book, in King's novel, the Overlook burns down.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this play out in the book?
This plays out because they have a similar thing happen at a trailer park that is built right where the Overlook was burned down.
Then it makes more sense to go back to the hotel. I like that better.
Well, as you said, Matt, in that first movie, the Kubrick movie, the Overlook is still standing. So, again, this must have been what he had to convince King. This had to be a big part of that conversation. I want to go back to that hotel. I want to bring back that imagery.
I thought of it like the end of the miniseries, where you see that it was being rebuilt.
I said at the beginning of this podcast, Adam, that we are not going to discuss that miniseries. Although there's one little instance from the book that I will get to the miniseries about in a little bit. But I think the sets are great. I know Flanagan worked tirelessly to get these as close to Kubrick's vision as possible. There are a lot of features on that Blu-ray that outline that. I think it looks great. I love the blood coming out of the elevator. And then, like, Rose the Hat just not even looking at it twice. She's like, oh, that's not a big deal, and just kind of walks away. I thought that was kind of cool.
I feel like every room that they fucking walked in had that elevator in it. Like, they walked into the lobby, and straight ahead, there was the elevator. But that's not where it was. But then they turn right, and they're looking down the hallway at the elevator. So I feel like that elevator shows up in like three or four different rooms inside the hotel. I'm also wondering at this point, because I didn't think they mentioned it, because she mattered earlier. I'm wondering where Wendy is, because I don't think at this point he had mentioned what happened to her. So I keep thinking that there's going to be a phone call or we're going to go back to her house. I think Wendy Torrance is going to show up at some point because they don't yet explain that she's passed.
Well, that's a good theory. I honestly never put that together, even as someone who had never read the book. As far as the iconography, I think Flanagan does a masterful job of, and his production company, of recreating the hotel. So much so they literally had to go to the Kubrick estate, get the blueprints.
Yep.
I think it looks great. Only one that really took me out as far as, like, you could have cut that was the blood elevator. Because it's so nonchalant. Literally, Rose looks down the hall, sees the blood elevator, and just keeps walking.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
That was of no importance whatsoever. Everything else I'm fine with.
Yeah, because that was...
It was just that one...
Yeah, that was such a huge part of that first movie, too. Like, Kubrick stays on that for so long, and you know, Danny's looking at this, and it's scaring the fuck out of him. Here, like you said, like, it plays nothing. It's just...
It reminded me of... I was trying to think of what remakes that reminded me of. Did you ever see the Total Recall remake with Colin Farrell? Where it really does do its own thing until they show the chick with the three boobs?
Yes.
It's the equivalent of that.
Hopefully we'll talk about that sometime in the next couple of years. All right, let's get to this. Deep breath. So Danny passes by the wall that his dad burst through and sits down, has a drink. Who's serving it? The kid from E.T. playing Jack Torrance, a.k.a. Jack Nicholson. All right.
I had no idea, though. I had no clue that we were going to get Jack. But to me, this also, as I brought up earlier, is the fundamental problem with who dies where, who stays where, who's evil, who's not, what is the power that we have.
Honest to God, I would have gone more with Steven Weber being in this fucking hotel. Then Henry Thomas.
As the person who says, we shall not talk about the media.
Yeah. Here's the problem. Here's the big, big problem. Steven Weber had a huge issue in that he had to play Jack Torrance. Here, Henry Thomas, who, from what I hear, he did a magnificent job in The Haunting of Hill House. Him and Flanagan are close. Flanagan made this decision to do it instead of going CGI. But Henry Thomas had to play Jack Torrance, a.k.a. Jack Nicholson. That is a no-win situation. And I think this scene just, it takes me completely out. You did not need this. You really didn't. You mentioned the CGI earlier, man. I could have honestly gone with if they DH'd Jack Nicholson here. I really could. Michael Douglas style from Ant-Man. I could have gone with Jack just kind of standing there serving this drink. It's a small enough scene. It's not even that long. It's a couple minutes. And this is kind of playing with, you know, Danny having the alcohol problem and kind of, is he going to do it? Is he not? Kind of like what Jack did in that first movie. I could have gone with that. I do not go with Henry Thomas as Jack Torrance.
Let me say that I would not have gone the Jeff Nicholson de-aging because he does not sound like he did in 1980.
Okay.
You would probably had to dub him. And secondly, I think this would have been creepier if you didn't see the bartender and you question, is he actually talking to somebody? I like the conversation. And he talks about, like, how the death flies, and the director's kind of talks about how his mom couldn't even look at him. I think Thomas, his delivery, I'm glad he's not doing a Jack Nicholson impression, because that would have been too much. Because Lord knows, like, Christian Slater's made an entire career out of that.
Why not get Christian Slater for it, then?
You could have got DiCaprio. Yeah. He's starting to morph into Jack Nicholson if you've seen him lately. But did you have to give him the hairline? Yeah. That piece looked so fucking fake. It looked like Woody Harrelson's wig at the end of Venom. It was that bad. And speaking of stuff that was cut, in the director's cut, they copied the scene in the bathroom where he talks to him again.
Oh, God.
Instead of being the bartender, he's, you know, you should correct the girl that you're with. Thank God Flanagan cut that.
Oh, yeah.
That would have set me over the edge. But this, the mechanics, I get why it's here. But if I had not seen him, I would not have been as off-put as I was. And I have no issues with Henry Thomas. I think he's a very good actor.
Mm-hmm.
But this felt like when Tarantino has to put himself in all his movies. I get you guys are BFFs, but could you not... Try to like make him the Bruce Greenwood character. You know, you could have worked around it. So I find this part's written well. I just wish you didn't see the bartender at all.
I like the scene. They seem to have Jack not fully in focus, and I think I appreciate a little bit because of that. I think you could have maybe shot it from the back over the shoulder, so you mm-hmm. see Jack without seeing Jack. I think that could have been a good way to do it. But I like that they're confronting each other, even though it's Danny confronting his demon being his dad as much as it is the bottle. I like, are you mistaken me for somebody else? You know,
yeah.
Is he Lloyd? Is he Jack? Like, I like that. I wish there was a little more of that to delve into the fucking house. But it's, I appreciate the scene and these two, you know, sitting there head to head as it is. But, you know, yeah, I could have done without seeing them. I could have done with just, you know, shoulders down and the hand putting it on the lit bar and that kind of stuff. But it, once I realized what they were doing, it actually didn't bother me.
So we get some more of the iconography. We have Jack chasing around the hotel. We get some images of that first Shining that Flanagan films pretty decently.
Mirror images. They're all in reverse.
Yep.
Literally everyone is a flip.
Yep. Good point. Very good point.
Yeah, and like I said, just to go back to what Adam said, I think the conversation is great. Like, it was written on the page.
Yeah.
I just, my big issue is just, at most, you could have had Danny look into a mirror, and you just see the back of his head.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And the hairline gives it away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't need to see his actual face.
So the spirit of Jack helps his son get rid of Rose the Hat.
Oh, I got to say this because I'm going to forget. When they cut to Ewan McGregor standing on that staircase with the axe, I swear to God, I yelled, "It's over. I have the high ground." You know for a fact you must have said that in an outtake or something.
You know what wasn't said in an outtake, and thank God it wasn't, was in the book, when Jack does this deed, get ready.
Uh-oh.
He blows Danny a kiss. Just
oh God,
kissing, that's what I've been missing.
He doesn't say that, but King says, from Danny's point of view, he's like, just like when we were younger or something. They didn't do that in the first Shining book. They did that in the fucking miniseries. He wants so hard to make that canonical. I read that and I fucking flipped. I could not believe he put that in here. I fucking could not believe it.
See, but the boiler room, it's almost like King's like, I'm going to get my fucking ending of the yes. boiler room blowing
oh,
up
yeah.
the goddamn
yeah.
hotel.
We're getting to the boiler room, don't worry. One other thing I wanted to say, though, about the iconography as well. Why put the twins in here if they don't look nearly like the twins from that first film?
They're not even identical twins.
They also look about 3 or 4 years older than they did in that first movie. You know what? They just age slowly, that's all.
Maybe they need steam.
You know, though, what I couldn't believe is they show the scenes from that original Kubrick movie, including Jack Torrance breaking through the door.
Mm-hmm.
Did they recreate Shelley Duvall without Shelley? Did they use that the new actress in that scene? Because I swear they did.
I think it's a body double.
Yeah, I think it is too.
Okay, because I'm like, that's not Shelley Duvall. Like, it's not a cut from that original movie. It looks redone.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I was wondering if they used that Shelley Duvall double from the early parts of the movie.
Yep. So, like Adam said, just like in that original Shining novel, the hotel explodes. And then at the very end, we see Abra. She's visited by Danny, who tells her to shine on as she heads down to dinner. And credits roll on this version of Dr. Sleep. Matt, is there a different ending, or is that exactly the way the director's cut ends as well?
No, the ending's the same, although Danny blowing himself up and seeing his mom, and they stare at each other, that works better in the director's cut.
Okay.
Because there's more content.
All right.
Her going to dinner and shutting the door in the bathroom, uh-huh. that's exactly the same. Like, it's not a director's cut with a radically different ending.
All right. That does it for Dr. Sleep. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Dr. Sleep? Oh, boy. Both of these should be interesting. I'll save the newbie for last. Matt, you go ahead and go.
If you recall, and I teased this at the end of the That Which Shall Not
yes.
Be Named, I mentioned that I put this in my top 10 of 2019. I don't know if I like it quite as much as I used to, but I still find this to be it's a very well-crafted movie, in my humble estimations. I think the atmosphere this movie creates with the Overlook in particular, as I was expecting a J.J. Abrams level of fan service. And I did not get that at all. I didn't feel like I was being insulted for the most part outside of the elevator. And Flanagan, I think, had an impossible task of trying to please both masters. And I think he did as good a job as possible, given the source material, which does not sound especially good based on what Garrett has told me throughout this discussion, as well as conversations with friends that have read the book. It benefits a lot from, it's a story about reflection and self-improvement. Not a lot of cheap jump scares, which I highly respect. It's got atmosphere. It's got the meticulousness of a Kubrick film without having the emotional distance of one. I'm not going to go so far as to call this one of the best King adaptations, because I reserve that for the ones that are just like top tier. But without having read the book, I'm curious to see, like I said, I'll read it eventually. I'll decide if this is indeed a drastic improvement. But I would give the director's cut a 9, because I think it fixes some of the pacing issues, and everything gets time to breathe. The theatrical cut is just a slight step down. I'm going to give it a soft 8. I think it's really solid. It's really well acted. And it gave me much more than I was expecting. I thought this was going to blow, because this came out the same year, not to showcase my thoughts too much. There was a Pet Sematary remake that came out that year as well that I fucking hated for reasons we will discuss 10 years from now. And this, I thought, was a very fun experience. And let me say, I saw this in a double feature with Terminator 6.
Oh, my God.
And I thankfully I saw that first, because I had a feeling that one would suck. So I could say both movies that I saw that night we have covered on this show. So I give it an 8. Yeah, if you're a fan of the Kubrick film, definitely check this out. And if you're a King diehard, I think there's enough here for you to latch onto, provided that you're not a huge fan of the book, because it sounds like they made some pretty big deviations.
8 out of 10 from Goudreau. Yeah, we have covered both those movies. Another movie that bases a lot of its appeal on nostalgia as well. Adam, sir, first-time viewer.
Yes.
What do you give Dr. Sleep?
First time. You know, going into this, I was a little worried because I didn't hear good things about it. I didn't hear good things about the book, and I heard less positive about the movie. But I was willing to go in open-minded and see what it gave me, because I've been surprised throughout this retrospective a lot, and I suspect that I'll be also surprised a lot in the next 10 years that we keep discussing King. Dr. Sleep's a good follow-up to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. The performances in it, really well done. Rebecca Ferguson as Rose the Hat is a fantastic villain. Kylie Curran as Abra absolutely steals the screen every time that she is on it. But the supporting cast really helped make this up. And that's surprising, because when you remember that original Shining, other than the very beginning and the very end, there's no supporting cast. It's three people, you know, in a hotel. Story, yeah, it's got a little bit of issues going through it. Matt has actually got me, I think, willing to go through and watch the director's cut. Chapter breaks are nice, man. It's especially because it's a book. I think if you're going to adapt something long like that and you're not going to do a miniseries, I think director's cuts where you have chapter breaks are a nice little way to do so. So I may go back and watch that. With this, and with a few of my issues between it, I had a good time. It's not a horror movie, and that part fucking bugged me. Stephen King, get a publicist and don't talk yourself, because when you're going to tell me that this is scary and it's not scary, that's going to give a level of disappointment, because it's not, doesn't fill my expectations. But as a drama-filled follow-up to The Shining, it definitely fits that mold. I came in with 2 scores, and I knew discussing through it which way I thought I was going to land. And I also had a feeling that if I decided to put this under the miniseries version of The Shining, I might not be invited back on this network. but I was happy with what I got here for the most part. Performances and tone. I'm excited to see what else Flanagan does with King's work, because I think he's been one of the better ones so far, even just this little bit in. So I'm going to give it a 7. Happy to see. And I think that this discussion has made me willing to go back and see the director's cut. Might be the best part of all. So 7 on 10 for Dr. Sleep.
You know, while watching this, I thought of a movie I haven't thought of since I initially saw it. And that was a movie Robert Zemeckis did a few years ago called The Walk, where Joseph Gordon-Levitt is literally walking this line across buildings for 2 hours. And I'm imagining Flanagan being Joseph Gordon-Levitt in this entire movie, just walking that line. All right, I have to please Kubrick. I have to please King. I have to. What a fucking masterful job. If this movie was based solely on that source material, this would be a low score. This would be a 2. Because honest to God, that book, both times I read it, dreadful. I'm sorry. I know a lot of people like it. I know a lot of people respect it for being different. I know a lot of people respect it for getting Mrs. Massey and Horace DeWitt out of the way early and turning it into something that people weren't expecting. I'm sorry. I need that feeling of dread. I need to feel this character's struggles, and I don't throughout both that movie and that book. But for what Flanagan does here, he is a master storyteller, because if you were going to adapt that book, this is as good as it's going to get. That being said, there are good shots here. There are great performances here. I really do think that Jacob Tremblay, for the small amount of time he's on screen, is fantastic. I think Rebecca Ferguson does okay. I think Ewan McGregor does okay. But the movie is so long, and I feel it by the end. I'm sorry, I still stand by the fact that I did not like when we went back to the Overlook. I think that drags this movie down. I think you would have kept this as a small, intimate story. It would have worked better. But still, Flanagan does what he does. I'm going 5 with this. I think it's tremendous in a lot of ways, but none of it have to do with King and the source material. And I'm saying that as a fan of Stephen King. I really am, guys. I swear, the last two podcasts haven't proved it, but I am a huge fan of this guy. But this book is not very good, but this movie is as good as it's going to get. And what this movie did, and what last week's movie did for me, guys, was bump that Shining score up a half point. I'm going 7, because what it made me realize is the job that Kubrick did with that Shining movie. He did as good a job as Flanagan did with that source material. And when you have two master filmmakers do it, it comes off so much better on screen. And the fact that King loves this version of his source material and hates Kubrick's version boggles my mind. So I don't know what else to say. We've covered all three movies on this, and I'm looking at that and like, yeah, that first Shining does get a 7 out of 10 for me now because of what Kubrick was able to do with it. This gets a 5. All right, boys, 2021 is about over, and so is our look at Stephen King, at least for now. Coming next year, we have Salem's Lot. We have Night Shift, and I think that'll be pretty much all of 2021 are those two fucking series, because the Night Shift has, from my last count, 23 movies to cover. Oh, but that does it for Dr. Sleep. Guys, anything else to add before we exit The Shining? Matt, do you have any final thoughts on what you've thought while watching this series?
This has been the most I love you / hate you retro we've done, because I spent the Kubrick movie saying, wow, I'm glad we're finally doing this. And then I spent the miniseries going, I fucking hate that you made me waste 4.5 hours of my life on this dreck.
Adam, what about you, sir?
You know, I thought by the time that we'd be getting through this, you know, we'd be getting ready and also talking about the Overlook TV series that I know J.J. Abrams supposedly is doing. And I'm very curious as to what the future holds for The Shining, for The Overlook, for The Shine, and all that. I know HBO Max passed on it, which when they own the rights to it is very fucking surprising. It makes me wonder what J.J. Abrams has done to it. Matt, you talked about a level of fan service. I wonder if that's all that was. But I wonder if we'll be returning to The Overlook sometime in the future. The thought of seeing how this all came to be and the beginnings of it would be something that would at least interest me and I'd be ready for.
All right, but that's for the future. For now, I mean, me and Matt, we still have more retros coming up. We got more stuff coming up. Stay tuned. God, very excited about what we have coming up, because I haven't been this energized to do this podcast in a very, very long time. I just cannot wait to dive into King. And will I be saying that when we're halfway into Night Shift? Stay tuned. But I'm just so happy that we're able to do this. But until next week, this is a magic podcast.
A little slow tonight, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Torrance. What will it be?
Now, I'm awfully glad you asked me that, Lloyd. Because I just happen to have 220s and 210s right here in my wallet. I was afraid they were going to be there till next April. So here's what. You slip me a bottle of bourbon, a little glass, and some ice. You can do that, can't you, Lloyd?
The Binge Aftertaste is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Congratulations, Dick!
Remember what Mr. Halloran said? It's just like pictures in a book, Danny. It isn't real.
Voice narration done by Adam.
How do you think you can handle that?
And are you concerned about me?
Of course I am!
Of course you are! Ever thought about my responsibilities?
Oh, Dick, what are you talking about?
Have you ever had a single moment's thought about my responsibilities? Have you ever thought for a single solitary moment about my responsibilities to my employers? Has it ever occurred to you that I have agreed to look after the Overlook Hotel until May the 1st? Does it matter to you at all that the owners have placed their complete confidence and trust in me and that I have signed a letter of agreement, a contract, in which I have accepted that responsibility? You have the slightest idea what a moral and ethical principle is, do you?
The Binge Movie Aftertaste is edited by Garrett.
I'm sure she'll be absolutely fascinated when I tell her about it. She's a confirmed ghost story and horror film addict.
This theme, while it plays like it plays an integral part of what comes later, is kind of silly. Why don't we just have this be blood?
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to become literal vampires. That's the only reason. Yeah.
Yep, agreed. I mean, we trade it out, and instead we get. I mean, it's literally like watching Life Force without the booze.
Another fucking reference.
It's the exact same effect.
It is. Yeah, it's a good point.
I was thinking of Oh, what is it? There's like an inhalant in the new Spider-Man game that gives them like superpowers temporarily.
Mm. Yep.
I was thinking that.
And I thought this was a pretty well done scene.
Yeah. The scene worked well.
Go ahead, Adam. Say that again.
Sorry. Okay.
You know, and that's a problem I have with the material in general, and this goes to the source material, is that King seems to have a lot of, what am I trying to say? A lot of favoritism towards Jack. Sympathy. There you go.
Seemed like everyone had that fucking elevator, though.
Well, I'm sorry. Say like that again, Adam, because I stepped on it. Say that again.
I feel like every...
I find this part's written well. I just wish you didn't see the bartender at all.
Adam.
I like the scene.
Oh,
I
damn it.
Hang on. I like the scene.